Welcome to the Tiny House Ideas Podcast. On today's episode of the Tiny House Ideas Podcast, episode 7, I'm joined by one of the partners from Tiny Heirloom in America. So I'll be having a chat with Jeremy Killian, one of the partners at Tiny Heirloom. We'll be discussing tips for you guys if you're looking to go tiny. We'll be discussing what happens behind the scenes at a tiny house building company and giving you an insight into what really does go into those tiny homes. And we'll also have a chat about the HGTV program, Tiny Luxury, that Tiny Heirloom were featured on. So yeah, for an insight into what goes on at a tiny house building company and to give you guys an insight onto what really goes into the tiny houses, then do stay tuned and listen to me and Jeremy's chat. Welcome to the Tiny House Ideas Podcast, the show where we talk about how to live a more fulfilling life with less. My name's Harry Alvarez-Garman, and I've got tons of exciting guests lined up for you, including authors, entrepreneurs, and tiny house owners. If you love minimalism, sustainable living, personal development, and everything in between, then you're in the right place. On the show, we'll be talking about how you can do more of what you love, how to turn your passion into a career, and how to live more sustainably.
So I'm Jeremy Killian. I am the CEO and half partner of Tiny Heirloom. Tiny Heirloom was founded in 2014. And as many of you guys know, it was on the HGTV show Tiny Luxury for 4 seasons. A little bit different face because people know the original owners as Tyson, Zach, and Jason. And in 2019 of March, I actually ended up taking over the company and buying it and then merging our company, Tiny Innovations, with Tiny Heirloom.
Okay, cool. That sounds good. So sort of like a brief background into what you guys do. So when sort of with the original founders, when was Tiny Heirloom first founded then?
So Heirloom was first founded in 2014. They actually were out of their backyard, believe it or not, just like how most builders start. And guys were in a position that they were building with their father-in-law, and it was kind of where the boom was starting with the tiny home, a whole realm of what is tiny homes. And they got in at the right time, and they built a pretty cool looking house, put it out there, and it kind of just spread like wildfire. And the next thing they know, they've got people knocking at their door saying, do you want to potentially go on television? And so I guess the rest is history. Tiny Innovations started in 2016. I was a home builder for almost 15 years with my partner, Ryan, and he's my cousin, my best friend. And long story short of that was about end of 2015, we realized that we wanted to build, we wanted to do design because we loved it, but we needed to understand that just relying on one market and being in the Portland market was really dangerous as a smaller builder. And if you're not a big builder, it can become, you know, one of those up and down waves. And so for us, we wanted to ultimately have security. We wanted to be able to do what we do, but do it basically nationwide, worldwide, however. And that's how we started Tiny Innovations. And so that's kind of how it all started.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And obviously, you say sort of 2013, 2014, and then obviously you guys, the innovations in 2016, must have been a great time to sort of join the market. Because I mean, as you know, everything sort of expanded and come so far since then. So it was obviously a really good time to sort of get into the market and get established for you.
It was a good time in the market. We had a niche, though. Our niche was we would build for other builders. So our hashtag was your builder's favorite builder. And what we meant by that was we were the builder behind the scenes building. And my first client was Tiny Heirloom. And that's how I started the relationship with Heirloom. A lot of people didn't realize we were building Heirloom's homes, you know, by the drones. And then we started building for other builders all across the United States.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. So sort of how did that take place? Then obviously you guys formed the relationship and then the merger that sort of happened later on a few years after. Was that sort of just because you guys had the relationship and they were looking to move on, or what was the situation there?
Well, it was a little bit of kind of both. They were in a situation, I think, ultimately that they were tired, and I don't want to speak for them, but make a long story short of it is there was some tension. There was definitely a lot of growing pains, and you know, we learned quickly that things needed to be done a lot different. And so when you have a meeting of minds and you're trying to change for the better, you hope that it's for the better, but it started to grow some definite tension. And it came to a point where they presented the option and we took up on it almost instantaneously, because we knew that for us, it was going to be a good move We knew we could take the brand and take it to even a much higher place. And we wanted to expand the brand. I wanted to make sure that the brand could become more than just a luxury tiny home builder. Ryan and I call it affordable luxury. And we wanted to basically allow people to have a piece of heirloom, but have it in something of a production model based, instead of just always custom. And so now we're doing both. We do custom and we do production, and then we do commercial. And so we've expanded the business, you know, substantially.
Yeah, definitely. And it sounds like sort of throughout the years, it's gone from strength to strength. Am I right in saying that you guys are the biggest tiny house builder in the US and Canada, and I'd imagine worldwide as well?
We're one of the biggest. I mean, there's a couple out there that are pretty big. But when you say like, who's the top five, we definitely rank, you know, we have, we worked our butts off to get there.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And obviously I like what you say as well, sort of about it being a piece of luxury as well. You're sort of, there's so many misconceptions, so many ideas around the tiny house movement that because you're sort of down, you're moving into a smaller space, you're downsizing, it doesn't mean that you need to sort of sacrifice the standard of living that you have. So I like that you sort of say it is still your piece of luxury, and it's still sort of like a really nice, still top quality product, but obviously just a smaller house, so it's not scrimping on the luxury or the quality or anything, which is good.
That's a big thing for us. You have to have a niche in your market. And so our niche was, everybody knew that Tiny Heirloom was a luxury builder. The misconception was everybody thought that you couldn't buy a home for under $100,000 US, up to, you know, $250,000. And that's true. Yeah. You can spend that much very easily. Mm-hmm. But we basically adapted our principles of our home building backgrounds and commercial. And ultimately what we did was, is we teamed up with some very, very, very good vendors, and we are all about product placement, product knowledge, knowing what is the right stuff to put into your tiny home. I will admit we've made our fair share of mistakes in the past too. Everybody does, but it's learning from those mistakes and learning what products work and what products don't. But we never wanted to scrimp on the luxury side of it. And luxury doesn't just mean a high taste in a Bentley in an airplane. It's not like that. It's luxury meaning that you can have the fit and finish and quality of those items, but you don't have to spend, you know, an enormous amount of money. And when you do stuff like production, production is key because it's repetition, it's muscle memory, it's pattern for the guys out back who work their butt off every day, and they're the ones that really make this happen. I just design it and then develop it. And so when you're doing custom, it's not an everyday thing, and that's where it becomes expensive, is because you're hand making every single facet of that tiny home. So the production based was taking the same quality, fit and finish, but ultimately putting it into, a production based model that's repeatable and, becomes more affordable.
Yeah, definitely. That makes sense. And it's sort of good that you guys have the variation between the custom tiny homes and obviously the sort of ones that you can not almost batch produce, but, you know, sort of repeat and do again in the future. So what would you say if you're sort of taking me from a project through from the beginning, sort of through to the delivery, the main differences between the custom and the production homes, would you sort of say, obviously, it's got a lot to do with the design and the speed of build, but if you were to run me through a project, say I was going to be looking at buying a custom home from you, would you just mind running me through the process of that?
Yeah, if someone goes in and they decide they're going to go production, basically what happens is they work with our sales manager, Brian, or my executive assistant, Margo. And what will happen is they will usually fill out what's called a design questionnaire. That questionnaire is really important. A lot of people sometimes wonder why we have those. And the reason we have those is we don't want to have to read your mind and then definitely not have the customer satisfaction there. And so when you're putting that information in there, I like this. It smells like this. It tastes like this. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
It comes down to what your needs and wants are and then what you're looking for. And then that helps someone like Brian, who's been doing this for a very, very long time. And he sees, okay, they like these different types of variations, these types of builders, these models they've seen on TV from, you know, our show or other shows. And then it allows him to really get into the nitty gritty. Once we do the consultation, we then put it in what's called a proposal form. And the proposal form is an online form that we produce, and it breaks down everything from the length of the trailer to the width of the trailer, what you're getting with the trailer, all your add-ons, your extras, discounting, shipping, the whole nine yards. And then it has your total, you know, price. And then from there, if the client decides they want to go back to the drawing board to save some money, or they want to add some stuff because it's below their budget and they want to put more into it, then they go to kind of like a round two with Brian. After we get that figured out and they sign off on the proposal, what then happens is we go into the design phase and into contract. And what we'll do is we'll set a contract at the next price typically. And then I always let the customers know you've got about a 2 to 3 week window in the design phase where they'll work with our architect. And we have an in-house licensed and bonded architect that works for us. Her name is Katie, and she's phenomenal. She does, she basically makes it come to life. She does all the animation, she does the floor plans, everything. And so she walks the customers through A to Z. She works on all the selection choices to make sure that at the end of the day, the customer is satisfied and they get what they want. Once they sign off on that, then we do either a modification to the contract and do a change in terms if it's applicable, whether it's a credit or a debit or both, it doesn't matter. Or we leave it as is if it doesn't change and it's in the budget that they had. And then we go to the trailer ordering process. We'll order the trailer. We use Summit Manufacturing. They're probably one of the best trailer makers in the country. They custom make all their trailers to our specifications and what we require. Wow, okay. That way that we don't have to guess, we know all of our tolerances, we know everything, we know our weight load distributions, our calculations, everything. Before we finalize all of it though, it goes to engineering. So I use a third party source. The reason I do that is it keeps us and the engineer at arm's length, and it allows no conflict of interest. It allows us to basically go to a licensed engineer, look at the plans, and then sign off on them. And after that's done, then we end up going, you know, to get the trailer ordered and in processed. Trailers usually take, you know, on a good season, 2 to 4 weeks. On a bad time, it can be anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks to be built. And then at that point, that's when we go into the ordering process on getting all the, you know, special materials, custom windows and doors usually. All those little fits and finishes that have to get ordered and take a longer lead time, so that in hopes by the time the trailer finishes and we get the notification that it's coming, and because they're only a couple miles away from us, it makes it a lot easier to obtain that trailer, but we got to make sure that we have all that product in here on time as well. And that's a trick right now with COVID. It's been a real tricky situation trying to get all that product here with all the delays that we see. And then it goes into the build process. So long or short of it, you're looking at anywhere from, I tell people, you know, 120 to 180 days on average is a custom build.
Cool. Oh, brilliant. Yeah, that is good. That is good, definitely. And then sort of on the topic of COVID, how has that sort of affected you guys, the business? How has that been?
Well, when it first happened, you know, and I say first, it obviously happened November of last year, and then it started to progress in December and January, but nobody, I'll say, took it serious, right? And everybody thought it wasn't going to be what it turned out to be. Mm. By the time March hit, it definitely left a mark. It devastated us just like everybody else. We had almost about $500,000 in closing ready to go, and then everybody fell through. Everybody, you know, had to put the brakes on. We had several bigger companies that we work with that had to file bankruptcies as well. And so it was one of those situations that, you know, you either take it on the chin or you basically dust yourself off and don't make excuses and you work harder. And so for me, it turned into 15, 20 hour days, 7 days a week. But I wasn't going to let it define us. I wasn't going to let it change us. I can't change things that have happened around COVID. March and April, probably the worst 2 months of our lives. And then at the end of April, beginning of May, things started to change and we started getting customers coming back. We started getting customers wanting to proceed with builds because we had customers in the build process say, I'm out of money. I don't have the ability to finish. We have to stop. And that's hard too when you're trying to stop production in the middle of production. And so the real turn was right around the 15th of May. And then June, July, and August, and coming into September, I mean, we did a record month last month, which I'm, wow, you know, happy. Now it's just getting everything tailored to all of the constant changes and unknowns. People don't realize, you know, it's hard because I try to stock all your base materials. But when you are doing custom stuff, or I'm doing commercial stuff, one-off stuff, a lot of people will have things in their units that typically have a lead time of anywhere from 2 to 8 weeks. Well, with COVID, I got to make sure they show up broken. They show up missing parts, packed wrong, distribution shut down, quantities are incorrect. And so we are in this never-ending cycle of chasing the distribution market. And so I've had to make a lot of changes in the last couple of months, and we're now at the point where we're going to be, you know, pretty much down to 4 or 5 vendors, and that's it. We're working with them. I know that they can provide the product that we need, but that also means that I'm going to have to tell people there are some things that we cannot do, or your timeline could double, triple, quadruple. And that's something that people are going to have to understand, because I don't dictate that market.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's such a pain. I mean, it's one of those things that it's not in your control, everything that's happening, all the distribution, all the stuff further down the line. So would you say that sort of major takeaway or the major change for you guys has been sort of reducing the amount of suppliers you work with and trying to sort of narrow down and work with fewer, but sort of keep that on track?
Yep. It's been a task trying to do that. But, you know, I think we've done a decent job navigating it. But you just can't get complacent. You have to make sure that at the end of the day, you are always on top of it and ahead of it. And for us, it's you know, we've gotten with some of the biggest vendors out there. But when you compare a tiny home company to the RV market, every single one of us are peons. There's nobody in the tiny home market that's doing the volume of like Airstream, Jayco, Coachman. These are companies out there that are using a lot of the same stuff that we use, mechanically especially. And when they're ordering, you know, $1 million in air conditioners, I can't touch that. You know, there's nothing that I can do. And, you know, of course, your reps and your people that are working with you are trying to fight for you. But then you find out that, you know, Airstream just completely annihilated and ordered everything in the moon. Leaves us to having to scramble sometimes, even paying retail. And then you don't make, you know, your profit margins.
Yeah, no, exactly. It is so difficult, but it's good to hear that sort of last month has been a really good month for you, and it's sort of hopefully going to build up as well. And something I was going to talk to you about in terms of that as well is with regards to COVID and sort of people having to be quarantined, stuck at home and learning the sort of things are changing and more working from home. Do you think that there's going to be an increase in the interest and the sort of people looking to purchase tiny homes over the next few months, years? Do you think it's changed people's perception about them, everything?
I think it's changed, definitely.
Yeah.
When the market had what it had happened to it in 08 to 012, and it was really by the financial market collapse, it affected worldwide, but it only affected a percentage of people. It didn't affect everybody, you know, and the difference is COVID has affected everyone. COVID has affected every generation, every business type, every country, you name it. And so for us, we have to do a lot of things here within the business. You know, we spent tens of thousands of dollars having to redo our entire floor. We had to set our individual stations up so our guys are protected. We can only, you know, with the social distancing, have basically 4 guys working on a tiny home at any one time, whether it's on the outside or inside, because the close proximities. And it's tough because even when you try, they still cross. People are going to get close to each other. There's no way around it. You know, it's one of those things that I have a full-time cleaner on staff that every hour they're out there and they're sanitizing. And I am thankful to say none of us have gotten it. Nobody on our team. And we've had as high as 32 people here at any one time working. So if it was going to happen, it could happen here very easily. But we've taken all the measures. It's just what's happened with that is it's left a huge slowdown. And so what would take us a day now is taking us 2 or 2.5 days to do something. Yeah. And I didn't pass that on to any of the customers. We took a huge beating in May and June on the current customer role, because I wasn't going to go back and tell customers, sorry, COVID hit, and now I have to increase your pricing because of other people's actions or because of distribution or whatever. And that's something I take pride in, although it's not hugely recognized, but it's something that's big, because almost any company could do modifications to contracts for that reason. Yeah. And I've tried to honor every single aspect of all of the contracts that we had. And that was 27 contracts. So it's a significant number. But I didn't want those customers affected any more than they already had been. As far as
that is respectable.
Yep. And as far as the ordering goes, yeah, I think that people are realizing that maybe having a big property or a big house or whatever, it might not need to be what they are thinking it needs to be. So ultimately, it's one of those things that is more about, hey, what does my life look like now that I have my kids at home, now that I'm doing, you know, learning over the internet, and I'm doing all of these things that I'm adapting to my life, and now I'm working from home. Do I need a 3,000, 5,000, 7,000 square foot home? Do I need to spend $3,000 to $15,000 a month in overhead? You know, an average trailer financed $500 to $1,000 a month. So you can't even get in Portland a one bedroom for anywhere near that. You can get basically a co-op, a shared housing for $1,000, and it's not going to be very nice. I think people are seeing that there's a lot of facets. I'm seeing the rental market, Airbnb. I'm seeing people opening businesses. And then the biggest thing is brick and mortar. People are realizing that they don't need their business in a brick and mortar. They can take their business on the road and make it mobile. And that's where we really specialize in, is because I have the commercial market and the understanding of the commercial market down very, very well. And that's why big names out there have trusted me, because they know that I know I'm going to always do the right thing for them.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that is a big thing, sort of the whole working from home, having your children at home, everything like this. It's sort of teaching people, maybe, like you say, maybe you don't need all of this space. Maybe you don't need to sort of be spending all this money heating a house, doing this, doing that, when in reality, as long as you've sort of got your phone and your laptop, you can have your work from home. You can sort of do everything mobile. And I think it is going to sort of lead to a change of perspective and sort of lead to more people looking sort of to move tiny and to explore to alternative lifestyles, I guess, which will obviously be really good for all of us in the sort of tiny house industry.
Sure.
So another question that I had for you, you've sort of spoken about you guys as builders. You said you had a team of sort of around 30 people, 32 people at one point. Would you mind sort of breaking down the roles, sort of how many people have you got sort of in the workshop building? How many have you got on design, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people don't realize how much it takes to operate a company like this.
There's a lot behind the scenes.
We're all doing six people's jobs. We're down to 21 people right now. So we've let go of some people. It all starts at the very beginning of your sales and marketing. And that's the main part of what I do for the business, is I bring the face of the company. My partner does the production side of it in the back end. So I am out there doing anything market-based, anything sales-based, and then I'm helping support the front end of this business. But I also have to know the back end of the business by the back of my hand, because it affects what we do on the front end. So we have sales meetings. And so it starts with kind of me opening the marketing. And then I've got my social media team. So that's Thomas. He basically does all of our videography, our drone work, our photography work. And he's a full-time, he's working basically nonstop. He travels all over. We're getting ready to do basically two deliveries and a road trip for 5 days. And then another road trip for 3 days. And him and I'll go like 20 hours straight and nonstop. Mm-hmm. And then it goes to Margo, who's my executive assistant. A lot of people know Margo. She's been with the Heirloom family ever since day one, 2015. Right at the end of 14 when they opened, she came on the company right when they became big. She is everything. She's our HR practically. She's our AR, AP. For those that don't know, it's account receivables and account payables. She does all of the contracts. She does all of the oversight on the paperwork. Plus my day-to-day, she oversees everything that I do, my scheduling, the whole nine yards. And then there's Brian. Brian's our sales manager. We had multiple and we realized it didn't work. What we realized is get key people out there and influencers who are all incentivized by making, you know, even if it's a few hundred dollars per deal that we do and they get paid on every deal, even if it didn't come from them, then I am able to have them go out there and market us as a whole. And so we've got some really key people out there that do that for us. And then in return, it goes to Brian, and Brian ends up doing the closing just because he is a wizard, understands it. And whether it's production or it's custom, he knows the lingo. He knows how to make customers feel important and obviously get to the brass tacks and not waste time. And then obviously, you know, close a deal for the client and for us. And then there's Abigail. Abigail is our logistics coordinator. She does the hell of a job of dealing with all the shipping and receiving nightmares right now, which is not easy. But she's doing a great job. And then we have Truman. Truman is our basically site manager. He oversees the entire front end of the production. So everything that happens in sales all the way to ordering, everything that starts with the trailer ordering process, all that stuff is Truman handling it all. He works in our Builders Trend system and has gotten to the point where now we're perfecting it to where everything is living within that system. And we're now using it religiously, which I wanted to do for years, but it just takes time and people. And then it goes to the backside and it starts with my partner, Ryan. He will handle all the production. He will make sure all of the stuff from fab work to framing all the way to siding and then sub work, completion, finish out, getting it ready for delivery, QC process. That's what he does. And then under him is his right-hand man, Aaron. Aaron's the superintendent. We call him the pit bull. I'm teaching him how to become a pit bull. He's more of a black lab right now. But he oversees the guys, the day-to-day. He has to basically be on the floor. He has to see the QC process. QC is quality control, making sure that things aren't getting missed, that things are being fixed and corrected as quickly as they can be. And still, even then, things get missed, you know, and then that's why we warranty what we warranty. And then from there, we have our production managers. That's Eric Gress, Mike Stockwell, Steven Olson. Those three guys and Matt Glenn, those four guys, excuse me, oversee every department from our framing, our paint, our finish, and then our mechanicals. They look at every aspect of the build and then they work with our floor guys who do the building. We have really decided that we're going to take a step back because we've done it all forever. And that's probably the biggest Achilles heel factor of us slitting our own throats is that we try to take on too much because I feel like if we do it, then it's done right. But the reality of it is that's how you burn yourself too. And I want my guys to be experts on everything, but I want them to be more of a QC and finish expert so that I can hire in subcontractors. So we are actually starting it out this next coming month of September, where we're gonna do our framing work, our siding work, and everything to almost finish to where it's gonna be subcontracted by experts. This will help with production getting through faster and then allow our guys to be more focused instead of basically on the task at hand, on the overall process at hand. And the key to that is to make sure that not one part of the framing is 100% perfect, but all of the framing is 100% perfect. Yeah. And ultimately, every aspect of it is that way. The reason I want to do that is I only have two options. One, I raise my prices 15, 20%, and then people become upset about that. And through COVID, we never rose our prices. We never, ever did a change order of price or raised our prices, even though I've been hit with huge cost differentials from suppliers. We probably will have to do a 5, 10% overall increase. That's going to happen. But at the end of the day, if I can get these guys having subs come in and do their jobs quicker and faster and alleviate things like our insurance costs, our overtime costs, our extra added payroll cost, our workman's comp, all of those things are factors. So if those get removed And these guys become just ninjas, is what I call them, in their field. My hope is that we're going to move faster, quicker, and then ultimately the cost will start to be able to go down. We'll keep our margins around the same. And then I don't have to continue to do this increasing in pricing like everybody else's.
Yeah, so. No, that makes perfect sense to sort of look at ways now, especially without it affecting the end side of it, the customers,
yep.
Being able to sort of streamline things now to sort of make the whole process easier. And you obviously mentioned that you're looking to sort of outsource now. Before you sort of transition into that, at the moment, sort of how much outsourcing would you typically do? Would you sort of try and do most things in-house, or would it be sort of electrics, plumbing, outsourced, or what are you sort of doing at the moment?
So
transition.
We have supers that are in their fields. So we have a hired third-party mechanical and HVAC company. By law, you do not do your own mechanical and HVAC when you don't have a super. It's someone who can sign off. It's someone that has the license to sign off on.
Yeah.
Same with your electrician. Those are the two biggest things I would never mess with. I have guys who can definitely adjust plugs, move things, but they're not going to sit there and wire a house and put that jeopardy of someone's life at stake. So we've always subbed those out to professionals that do that, and that is their sole job. But we have the relationship with those subs that they live here. I mean, they practically live here. I mean, they're here 24/7. We have in-house underneath those guys that are basically looked over. So we've got Christian, who does our mechanicals and plumbing. He's got his plumbing license. So I do all our in-house plumbing. That's fine. We're not doing things like mains and big old, you know, jobs like you would with a residential home. It's PEX, it's ABS, it's Flex. It's nothing that nobody can't do if they are a journeyman or a plumber. My HVAC guy comes in and checks off on everything, checks off on all the seating and all of this stuff. He runs all the HVAC lines. He does all the gas lines, anything that's to do with the propane, LP conversions, you name it, that's him.
Yeah.
And then my electrician does all of the main panel, the home runs, all of the mass wiring. We have worked very hard and we do all of our wiring through conduit chases. Everything is ran, our plumbing, everything underground. So we build above our subframe. And we basically level out. We use a drop axle trailer, and we level out to the fender wall so that everything is like almost a deck over a flatbed trailer, so to speak. We get 8 to 9 inches roughly, and we use marine grade pressure treated lumber wood. So that way that we have no rot, no issues. It's been treated and sprayed. And then we use a 20 gauge steel pan in between the trailer frame and then the actual, and it's a top mount, fully welded and sealed trailer frame, and then the subfloor channels. And in our subfloors, that's where all the mechanicals get ran, all the chases get ran, and then we do an electrical and HVAC and plumbing layout plan. So this way, when you're in the house and it's completed and you want to move a socket or you have a socket go out, no more of the times of opening up the walls. All you got to do is open the socket area, and then you can pull the line and just rabbit chase it. And so that's where you leave that to the professionals. We did everything else. Everything else was us, other than roofing. Sorry. Roofing, I've never – Heirloom previous to me did roofing. Biggest mistake, warranty nightmares. You need to be a roofer. And especially when you're using two different types, you either have to use on flat roofs and a flat pitch, a membrane. A lot of people will use like TPO or EDPM. We use PVC, highest quality. It's a single unibladder, essentially, kind of like rubber, but it gets completely surrounded within the roof line in one unibody piece. And so my roofers do a great job. And then with metal, we use standing seam. We're getting ready to introduce new technology coming from Australia, from a company that we're basically finishing up a partnership with. That is going to have probably the greatest technology I've ever seen in metal roofing and siding. It's got seamless seams, if you can say that, seamless seams, where you don't have a seam anymore, which eliminates complete water intrusion. And then our spray foam too. Spray foam, we've all tried it. Don't do it. It doesn't work. You need to use a commercial grade closed cell spray foam. That way you don't have off-gassing, you don't have chemical issues, you have a company that comes in, knows what they're doing, they spray it correctly. And we spray from the cavity all the way out to the studs, and it's nice and tight everywhere from the sidewalls to the roof lines are all sprayed. The only thing we don't spray is our subfloors. Everything is used with 2 to 3 layers of 1.5 to 2 inch rigid foam, which is a great insulator. And then we do that so that if there is ever a plumbing issue or problem, you can literally pull a trailer up just like a car at a Jiffy Lube bay. And you can go from underneath, you can penetrate the pan and ultimately get to any of the locations because we have locations marked. And then you can seal the pan and weld it right back up and go on with your day and fix the issue. So that's what we use our subs for. I'll never sacrifice that. They are, I say in-house subs in a sense, because like I said, they live here. They're here all the time, but they are their own businesses and their own third parties for a reason.
Yeah, yeah. I completely understand what you're saying about sort of having sort of experts in that field who can come and sign off for stuff and be separate to you guys. And I think the sort of attention to detail, and I mean, even the tiny details that sort of customers and stuff wouldn't obviously notice sort of behind the walls, having the rigid foam in the floor, having the sprayed foam in between the stud walls and everything. It's sort of the little details like that that sort of make it easier for repairs and for things further down the line. And I think sort of really does set you guys aside as well from other builders that will sort of just go for the quickest, cheapest option. Whereas in reality, it's sort of a lot more important to sort of do it right the first time, and then in future it will sort of save so much money, time, ag, all that sort of stuff. So it's good to see that you guys sort of put so much time and effort in initially, which obviously then pays off further down the line.
It really does, because if you don't do it right, you end up in warranty nightmares, and then it's your reputation too. You know, when I first came onto the company, you know, we had hundreds and tens of thousands of dollars in warranties that I, you know, I wasn't happy about. It wasn't stuff I did personally, but we've had our own warranty nightmares previous too. And we still have them occasionally, but it's gone from nightmares to like fun dreams, I call it, because it's grown exponentially from where it was. And again, that's making the transition of, you know, taking a small business and learning from those mistakes like everybody has, but then it's owning the mistake, and then it's now transitioning into a much better product. And like I said, putting the right things into these units is key so that you don't have these issues, and then you don't have nearly the warranty mistakes. You'll still have warranties, but it should not be major issues or problems if you're using the right products. And that's what I try to install on everyone here and in sales and talking to clients, because if they start to understand it better and learn it better, then they start realizing the value that you bring to them from the next person.
You're paying for.
Definitely. No, you pay for what you get. Let me tell you, you pay for what you get.
That's the thing. And you can do it right and do it once, or sort of do it wrong and then have to, as we say, go back to it again. And that's just sort of unnecessary if you obviously put in the time and effort initially.
I'm just going to give a quick mention to Tiny House Ideas. So Tiny House Ideas is my business, is my company. It's been what I've been working on for the last 5 years in the long term, and especially over lockdown, over the last year or so, I've really put some time, energy and effort into building this business. So Tiny House Ideas obviously started with an Instagram page, and it has grown and developed into the business that it is today. It's the perfect free platform for anyone interested in the tiny house movement, in the tiny house community. First of all of the images that I feature on Instagram, you can find out more information, you can get a full fact file over on the website. As well as that, there's a really cool tool called Find Me a Builder, where for free I will personally pair a few tiny house builders with you based on your requirements, and that will save you going through hours and hours of searching through Google results. Take the stress out of it for you, really. And obviously it's no obligation. I'll send you a few recommendations, and it's up to you what you do with them. Another section of the website is the approved builders section. So I've been working with a few tiny house builders that I really stand behind, that I see the value in their work. So there's a profile there to sort of tell you more about them, and so you can contact contact them directly if you've got any jobs that you're interested in. And finally, on the website, there's a section for tiny house vacations. So if you guys are looking to go away and to try the tiny house movement, to try the tiny house living, but don't know if you want to commit to it, if you don't want to live there just yet, then a vacation is a really, really great way to sort of get acclimatized, to learn more about it. And you can do that by clicking on the vacations tab of the Tiny House Ideas website and learning more and searching through some amazing holiday homes.
All right, so another question I had for you. So sort of speaking about the business and what goes on behind the scenes and talking about now sort of looking to outsource and subcontract some more things, what are the sort of longer term 5-year plans, say, for the business?
So the biggest thing I think for us is we're in negotiations of bringing the show back,
okay,
but differently. And the biggest of all is our YouTube channel. And yeah, it's going to be there for a lot of reasons. I am an open book. I'm very transparent. Some people will love me and some people will hate me, and that's okay. At the end of the day, I want people to see the entire good, bad, and ugly of the situation. And we're going to show it all. I'm not afraid to. The reason being is people like drama. People love to pick people apart. And I'm okay with that. It doesn't bother me. I don't let it affect me personally, no matter what the situation is. What I like about it is that you can't say that we're not telling you the truth. And by doing that and having all the cameras and everything going, what it's going to show is it's going to show from the start, conceptually, of a client to how a build starts to the finish process. And we're going to document that over and over again. And yeah, people are going to see our growth and people are going to see that we truly do care. A lot of people just think it's based on a pretty picture on Pinterest and on Instagram. What they don't realize is what it takes to get to that picture. And that is the biggest key message I want to show. A lot of people don't even know. I do a huge amount of our deliveries to the clients. And I do that because A, it's my product that I'm putting out there. And B, if something's going to happen in between a unit coming off of production and then we only have like a day of testing, that's not enough time typically. So if it's going to happen, it's going to happen under my watch. And then when I deliver that tiny home, I can be there to either A, fix the problem, C, get somebody to help fix the problem. And then, you know, if there is no problem, ultimately delivering it and making sure a client understands the whole aspect of a home, how it works, the whole nine yards. It's finishing a process and giving that customer closure so that they don't feel like they just bought or spent this a large amount of money and then where did everybody go?
Behind it. Yeah.
You know, and I don't want them to feel like that. You know, I can't be on every delivery. I want to be, but that's going to be a big part of this growth. The other part of our growth is the commercial market. Everybody knows that I've done a lot of commercial builds and I've worked with the huge companies, whether it's a small company, a medium company, or a large company, I don't care. I love commercial builds. I love the way that what they resemble. I love doing them. And I want to pioneer things and become known for not just a normal, you know, no disrespect to anyone out there, but I don't want to be a mom and pop tiny home builder. I want to be a builder that can have a mass production line, grow that line, have that line almost self-fed, do the custom units and the one-off units, and then do the commercial. And so we have a lot of projects coming up. We are working with some big, big names to put out some pretty huge tiny home, you know, they're just going to be awesome. That's all I can say right now. I don't want to spoil it, but it's going to be a lot of fun and hard work, but I'm not afraid of it. We also are coming out with our first online real store. It's going to have, and it's going to debut as soon as potentially end of next week. We're trying to get it up the end of this week, but we don't know if it's going to happen that fast. But what's nice about it is it's going to give people the chance to have a little bit of tiny heirloom. If they can't necessarily afford a tiny home at the moment, they can have a piece of us. We're going to have everything from, you know, swag. We're going to move that line and excel on it as much as we can, from every aspect of beanies, hats, you know, face mask coverings, shirts, sweaters, that. But then we're also going to do our signature series models in A to Z floor plan and build plans, so people can buy them now. They also can buy them with our trailers from our trailer manufacturer. So we're going to put two packages together so that if somebody is a DIYer and they want to do it themselves, but they don't know where to get started. Now they'll have an entire, what we'll call Bible of the plan.
Yeah,
and then they'll have the actual trailer that that plan goes on. And that's where a lot of people get themselves in trouble. They'll buy a builder's plan, but they don't understand those plans were made for their trailers.
Yeah.
And then we're going to have starter kits. We're going to have everything from your electric options to your gas and LP options to your plumbing options. And basically, they're going to have fulfilled items in there that every DIYer would need. And they get the ability to be below MSRP if they were to go to a straight store and order this stuff, and they're not a manufacturer like us. And they'll be able to get a discounted pricing. Most of them are about 10 to 20% below, so that there's still enough room there and available room there for them to get a, you know, that discount get the products they need. And so that's what we worked on all this year since January. We worked on getting the store up together. A lot of people don't realize the YouTube production. We started it last year, at the end of last year, and then it had to stop. And we had stuff that we had to take care of. And then ultimately, I actually ended up changing cameramen. And the new guy I got, Thomas, he's really good. And he can do it all, editing. Because I am not that person. He can do the photography and the videography. And it's nice because his schedule allows him to, like, when I tell him, hey, we got a four-day road trip coming up, he's game. And we just do it. So... Amazing. It's exciting for us because I think people are going to get the first untold truths and stories, especially from a big company in the sense of the business. We're a big company that a lot of people like to hide the behind the scenes. I don't. I want people to see it, because that to me is every bit of the value that we're going to bring to the customer. And then they're going to see how hard we work for them. Because I'll tell you, there is a harder working group of guys here. Yeah. You know, I spend hours in line trying to get stuff for people and do stuff to make sure that their build doesn't have anything missing that they paid for. And then on top of that, when you're dealing like what I told you about with the distribution issues, we sometimes have to go to Home Depot and we'll spend an hour, 2 hours, an entire 8 hour day going to five different Home Depots because they say they have something in quantity and they don't. It's why we're getting away from the retail vendors as much as possible and trying to be with all wholesale vendors on the back end. But it's hard because there's products that some of them don't carry. And so, you know, it's just, I think if that more than anything can show the viewer and the consumer what it really takes, the nitty gritty of it, everything from like when we are driving a tiny home and we'll have a tire blowout, they don't realize that's a 5 hour delay right there. You don't just jack up a 20,000 pound tiny home on the side of the road.
They just change it easy.
It's not. And so when people can see almost your pain and misery in a way, it's funny. I'm not going to lie, but I think the better of it is that people realize, oh, this is what they have to do just to get this thing. Not even finished and done, but now delivered to me. So that's why I want to show it all, so people can really, really see the lengths that we go for our customers.
Yeah, no, I like that because, like we said, we spoke about this before, before on the podcast anyway, sort of saying there's obviously the advantages of sort of all Pinterest, stuff like that, but is more important is sort of seeing the behind the scenes, seeing raw, unedited, what goes on, what happens, all the sort of mistakes, questions, everything you learn from it sort of makes you guys more real, sort of makes you sort of easier to trust and to sort of form a relationship with as well. Because I mean, it's all well and good seeing something perfectly polished and finished, but if people don't understand or appreciate everything that sort of goes on behind the scenes to sort of make that a reality. So it is sort of good to sort of focus, as you guys do so much on the Instagram with the big following and the YouTube subscribers, all that sort of stuff, and to sort of share the behind the scenes, I think is really important nowadays, especially.
Well, it is. And people have commented on that because Heirloom before me would never show behind the scenes ever. They would only show the pretty pictures at the end.
Yeah,
and to me, I don't want to say in a negative way, but it seems fake to me, you know, because a lot of people don't realize, even on the TV show, a lot of those homes weren't even finished when they were debuted on the show. They would have an area where the siding wasn't even done yet because they were getting rushed so quickly to get them done. And so for me, it gives me a chance to show everybody this is what it looks like. Yeah. And then you have so many critics out there and people out there. And so at the end of the day, I got nothing to hide. Our technique, our build techniques, the way that we do what we do, I'm okay debuting that. And I'm okay if somebody says, hey, why are you doing this in this fashion? It looks wrong or something yeah. is different. Because at the end of the day, I'm not going to turn around and comment back and say, well, how do you know? I'm going to actually go to my supervisors or my leads and say, hey, guys, what is this about and why is somebody saying this? And if there is something wrong, then hey, at least I can fix it a lot yeah. faster than others. And yeah. I don't have an ego, so it's okay. And then if it isn't wrong, it isn't wrong. And I still don't need to fight with the person because people are going to be positive. People are going to be negative. You know, it's all the same to me. It's more about giving people that ability to say, look behind the scenes, do something that's different. Because I think that's what makes people in the YouTube world who they are is they've always done something a little bit different. They found their niche and then it becomes very successful for them. And yeah. for me, if I can offset the cost of things like COVID and things that do happen that are like just completely out of everyone's control, and I can start bringing in other income avenue and revenue on that as well, then I can take that money and I can put that towards good instead yeah, of going to a customer and saying, hey, Mr. Customer, because COVID hit, you know, I know we have a contract and your build's 110 grand, but I can't do it now. And I need 125 grand just to make up for these pricing yeah. increases. Like I said, I've never done it. I have never had to go back to somebody and tell them that they owe me more money. I've had two people who had became homeless, and I just wish we would have been able to document that back a couple of months ago and the whole process, but we didn't at that time because I didn't have the cameraman at that time to do it. But ultimately it was a real situation and I had to make the decision. Am I okay losing $10,000-$12,000 on these bills to make sure that they can get their house in the end of the day and then they have a roof over their head? And I waived it. I waived the cost of the finishes on those. And, you know, it's not something I can do for everybody, obviously, because I would be out of business, but I knew the importance of that person having to make sure that they had their home and that they had a roof yeah. over their head because they were truly homeless. And that to me, you know, I was there. When I was younger as a kid, I was homeless. I lived on the street for 2 years. I know how that's like. It's not somewhere that anyone wants to be. And so, yeah. you know, it was something that I knew that was important to do. And that's the stuff I wish I could have shown because that's the reality and the rawness of it where people yeah, need exactly. to see it. It's real. It's
yeah.
life.
Yeah, exactly. And now with sort of social media being such like for some people, such a highlight reel, and they're only showing sort of, they're only sharing with you 10 seconds of their day and you sort of think, oh, you're sat here, but then they're off doing this and doing that and it's also perfect, but it's not. And it's about, and I think people are starting to see through that now a lot as well. So it's important to sort of move with that and make sure that you guys are sort of being as real as you are and sort of showing everything that does go on, that things do go wrong, but that's life. And it's sort of about how you get past it that's important rather than sort of how you try and cover it up.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. But also sort of speaking about these plans and the merchandise and what sort of stuff is an awesome idea. And by the time this podcast goes live, sort of looking at about mid-October time, we're filming this for those that are listening towards the end of August. So obviously all the merchandise and stuff will be up. So there'll be links for you guys to go and check that out and everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so now we've obviously had a chat about everything that goes on behind the scenes, the back end of the business, all that sort of stuff. So sort of now going in the direction of sort of once the tiny house is finished and sort of looking at a finished product, there's some questions that I have here about that. So I was going to ask sort of about the biggest and the smallest tiny homes that you've built and sort of what's been the difference in the production from the biggest house and the smallest house.
Smallest house I've ever built myself, 12 feet. 16 feet was the smallest completed house. 12 feet was partially incomplete. And then the largest we've ever done was 44 feet. And that was a gooseneck. Illegally, that's like the largest you can do. And that was for a client on a quad axle. That's four axles, 28,000 pounds. It was a monster. It was a beast.
That is seriously big. Yeah.
Yeah. The biggest thing is not being overwhelmed. I came from luxury home building, so I built homes at 5,000, 6,000 square foot previous.
Yeah.
I know the building side of the business very well. And it's just a larger order of process. That's really what it comes down to. And it's just more attention to detail. Larger build, you have more room to make more errors and mistakes. There's a lot of square footage and real estate that covers on that build.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the finished product was one and the same, you know, and it doesn't matter if it's as small as 12 feet or 16 feet or as big as 44 feet. It's just a matter of the process in the build. And that's where I have to spend every day a part of my time on the floor, because I have to go through those homes. I put my eyes on those homes. I touch them. I make sure to see and try to find a lot of those little errors, because, you know, you don't want a warranty on a 44 foot home. It's a lot of home.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And how have the sort of clients that you've had, how have they acclimatized? And obviously I'd imagine you're in touch with a lot of them still. How have they sort of found the transition from conventional houses, bigger living, to the tiny houses that you sold them?
For the most part, I'd say 90% of them have stepped through it and done it. And now it's an everyday part of their life and they're happy, and they would probably never change anything about it, other than I've had several of them decide to change their tiny home and get a different one, and we've built them a second tiny home. The 10% others, I've had people try it and it's just not for them, and they end up using it as a rental, a vacation home, just a traveler, an RV once in a while, or they sell it. And that's why we have the consignment program. The consignment program was designed for clients that either upgrade or downgrade or get a second unit or a third unit, and they want to sell a unit that we built, that we can basically put it on our website and sell it to them, to the general public. And I basically go through them. I try to recertify them as best as I can. You know, obviously they're used, but I would say less than 10%, honestly, ever go to that level. I think I've only had one or two clients in my six, almost 7 years doing this in total that have been just absolutely, I wouldn't say devastated, but more irate and upset and wish they would have never have done it type thing. And it's for their own reasons. It's not what we did on the build. It's just that they regretted the whole process, and that happens. And I can't change that. All I can do is offer them the facility and the help and say, look, I know the right places to help either sell it, or have you thought about doing this? One of them that was really upset ended up listening and turned hers into a rental and started doing really well on the rental side of things. And that was nice, because it was rewarding to realize there are aspects and facets to every person's reality. And for the other 90%, they just love it. I got people that travel all over the country. And then I got people who are stationary in inner city, big cities like Portland, Seattle, Texas, Chicago, all over the country. And then rentals and Airbnbs and out in the middle of nowhere. Right. And yeah. I've done it all. I've seen it all.
So what would you say would be sort of your main piece of advice for the listeners to take away if they are sort of in the process or at the stage now where they're debating or looking at going tiny, and to sort of try and avoid those issues of not acclimatizing or rushing into it? What would be your best advice for them?
My best advice for anybody is know your builder and know who you're working with, regardless of the situation. It has nothing to do with tiny heirloom. It has to do with people are professionals and what they do. And as I think people all over the country, not Americans only, all over, they realize you're not going to go buy a car or a vehicle of any kind and there's a manufacturer with no information.
Yeah, you've got to do your research.
You just don't. You don't do that. Yeah. You're going to places like Mercedes, Honda, you know, Kia. It doesn't matter who it is. Rolls Royce. It doesn't matter who it is. You're going because the brand of what you like, the budget of which is appropriate and what you can afford. And ultimately, you're going because usually it's when you're buying a new car, you're buying a peace of mind, something that's covered under warranty, something that you know has a reputation. I always tell people, you can't buy off of price. You need to buy off of facts. You need to buy off of knowing that your builder is a registered builder. And when I say that, in the States, you need to be a manufacturer and a licensed dealer. You have to have two different licenses and accreditations.
To even start, yeah.
A lot of people don't have their manufacturing license, and it's because the insurance is so expensive. It's a $100,000 policy a year cost to me to have my manufacturing license. The reason that is because I'm putting basically a vehicle of sorts on the road. I'm giving it a VIN number. I'm giving it the value behind what we're charging, and it's in the NADA guide. It's the VIN number is our VIN number. It's not the trailer manufacturer that made the flatbed trailer, and people don't realize that. So education is key, because if you don't understand those things and then you buy off of price alone and you say, oh, this builder is $35,000 for a home. Well, why is he $35,000?
Exactly.
Because I can't build it for 35 grand, even if I wanted to.
Yeah.
And that's where the education comes into play, because you have to understand the whole process of everything from A to Z. And then it's the quality behind it. And then it's also knowing that you have a builder who stands behind their product. I have very rarely declined a warranty, even when it's past the 1 year builder warranty. If it's something that we know that we did wrong and it is absolutely an issue of a defect of what we did, I will take ownership of it even past my standard 1 year builder warranty.
Yeah.
But what I can't do is put out product there. And this is why I tell people product is so important, because people will want some of the most naturals of wood. Mm. That's not meant to go on a tiny home.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wood swells, wood wicks. Wood absorbs water. And so what happens is even though when it leaves the factory and it has two or three coats of finish on it and clear or whatever it is, you have to maintain that. People don't get that.
People don't.
So 6 months later, I'll get a call and somebody will say, well, why is my siding starting to buckle? You installed it wrong. No, we put the relief cuts. We have the flashing. It's because you forgot you live in a very treacherous climate, and when you have the end of sun here in summer and now all of a sudden it's snow and rainfall and all that,
it's completely
you have to make sure that you keep applying and sanding and putting those coats on there. People don't realize that. So I got rid of a lot of the natural wood on the outside because of that reason, because I knew that if I could make it easier for clients and make it understandable for clients, they would get it, but they would appreciate it, and they wouldn't have to do that. So you have to know the right builder. That builder has to be able to explain all this to you and give you your pros and cons with what you do. For the DIYers, if you're building for yourself because you know you want to build something for a domain, it's your property. You're going to live in it. That's one thing. But if you're going to build it because you need to make an income, then you need the responsibility behind building it, no matter if you're a DIYer or you're a corporation. And that is why you have to have the right insurances, because if you make a mistake and you don't ground your wiring correctly, you're on a metal frame. Well, what does water and metal do and electricity?
Exactly.
Poof. So at the end of the day, you need to know and make sure that you understand what you're doing, because not only are you putting your own life in jeopardy and your loved ones and your family, but if now you're going to rent it, sell it, to me, you don't have the business in doing that, unless if you're a manufacturer, because it goes back to the principle of what are you buying? I know that they can't give you a license plate. They can't let you have a registration. And if they do, it's on the trailer. And people don't realize that. You're buying a trailer as a flatbed trailer typically. And that's what people will register with their MVDs or DMVs. It's their motor vehicle departments, essentially, where they get their licensing and their plates and their registrations. They don't realize that basically is zero value now, because what about the structure? That's what makes a tiny home a travel trailer or an RV, a recreational vehicle. And they only can do that if you have the licensing.
Yeah, exactly. And that is so important, because I mean, there's so many
huge
avenues that we could go down. That sort of, that's why it's so important. Like we say, just do it properly the first time. It will sort of pay off. So I'd say that is sort of a really good takeaway for those that are listening, to sort of do the research, make sure you know what you're investing in, what you're doing, because it is such a big decision. It's like you wouldn't buy a car, you wouldn't buy even an oven without doing the sort of proper research, that sort of stuff. So it is, shouldn't be looked over at all.
Exactly. That's
another question I had for you. Yeah, it is, definitely. you mentioned earlier that you sort of your initial background in house building was sort of on the largest side, sort of 5,000-6,000 square feet houses. Where did the sort of transition start? What sort of sparked your interest in tiny houses and going to almost the other end of the spectrum and building tiny after building so big?
So I used to be known in Portland for basically doing one-off custom and then renovations. And I would love to take like historics and homes that everybody else would tear down and build a brand new cookie cutter home. I would preserve it and I would add on to it, or I would do extra. The problem with that is a lot of that had lead and abatement issues and health concern. And so you have to know what you're doing very well. And I did. I had my lead-based license. I knew how to handle asbestos correctly and do the things that you needed to do. My last house was done on one of the most historic areas of Portland and Southeast. It was on Reed College Place. Reed College Place is actually home to Steve Jobs, and it's where he went to college.
Yeah.
Reed College is actually, there's a statue of Steve out there, and he had his house like within a block and a half from where I did this house. Wow. The house that I bought ended up becoming an asbestos and a huge, huge, just lead nightmare. To the point of renovating it made no sense. So I took it down, cleared it, and I put a 4,400 square foot retro historic. So when it was done, I had 2 years of hell. I had every neighbor pissed at me and every person out there mad at me. Yeah. But then when it was done, it looked like it was almost a 100-year-old home. It was painstaking. It was a lot of work. And I realized then, hey, I can do that. I can have that finish and that fit in the feel that I want to give people. But why not do it tiny? Why not do it in a way that becomes more economical too? Because I've lived in a 7,000-8,000 square foot home. And then I've lived in a trailer, a single wide. I was no happier or unhappier in either way. And I realized I don't need all that space. I don't need, you know, to be in 10,000 square feet because I could. I wanted to be somewhere where I was happy and I wasn't just living for a mortgage payment and I could just be flexible and do what I wanted to do. So it was a combination of all of that. And that was ironically the last house I ever built on the residential side. And it just gave me a rude awakening of take what you know best of the building world and then create something that is so much more repeatable and I can make money quicker for doing what I love to do. But then I can really fulfill a void for people out there because of, we started seeing it here in Portland, the housing crisis. There was a shortage.
Exactly.
Portland never let verticals go past 9 stories on the east side of the Willamette River specifically. Now all of a sudden they're giving $20 million grants to put 30-story home, verticals up. And I didn't understand why they were doing it until I realized, oh my God, there's no more land. There's no more inner city availability for people to basically live. And then these same houses 3 years ago when I stopped, so in 2013 and 2014, that I was paying sometimes $200,000-$400,000 for, I'm now paying $600,000-$800,000. And then I still got to tear it down and build a new house.
Hmm.
By the time I'm done, I got to sell this house for $2 million. It became where, as an investor, an investment, it didn't make sense. For $2 million, why don't I go build 20 tiny homes?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that is the difference. Yeah. So what have you sort of seen as the main takeaways from, obviously, the construction or sort of basic processes are the same, but have you sort of taken anything away from building the bigger homes into the tiny homes now? Are there any sort of tips and tricks for making such a small home seem like it's bigger? Is it sort of natural light, light walls, or what would you say is the main sort of
window placement? Yeah. Window and door placement is key, and knowing where your strengths are. And I am phenomenal when it comes to design. But I let my architect and my engineers really play with the modeling of light and the best usage of it in those types of bigger windows. But you got to be careful because those bigger windows can shatter too. So you got to have the right glass in those windows. Again, know your products and know what your builder needs to know so that you're not going down the highway and shattering an 8-foot window.
Yeah.
But to get that volume and that height It's either a linear line. It's knowing how to run the flooring in the right direction, lighter colors, brighter. That way that it feels more open, lighter tones of wood and composites even. That way that you're not feeling so dark and so caved in.
Exactly.
And then knowing how to manipulate structure so that you can get different elevations. And what I like about tiny homes is the challenge. And that was one thing that I got bored of with regular houses. There was no challenge there for me anymore.
Yeah.
Tiny homes, it's such a small footprint. And then you want to take like a, my style is a lot of contemporary. I love modern contemporary looks. So I want to put, you know, those 5-6 foot pop outs and then have those big walls of steel structure and glass. And I'm like, well, how the hell do you do that in tiny home? And so learning how to use those elevations and marrying the materials is huge. You use 80% of residential based knowledge and construction material in a tiny home, but then there's 20% of it that has no business doing in a tiny home. And you need to know why an appropriate RV product is really there in the RV world for a reason. Because you got to know everything from your BTUs, the type of LP from your propane, converting into that gas that goes into the home so that you're not using a standard appliance. It drives me nuts when I see tiny home builders putting standard gas ovens in a tiny home. It's so far illegal to do that, and it's not even safe to do that. And the reason is the BTU burning rate is so much greater, and it takes so much more of a volume of gas to come in. That you are either going to poison and kill yourself before you know it with carbon monoxide, or you're going to end up combusting the line. And so you need to know when to use those right products. And again, it's about 20% of products that are in the RV industry that you need to make sure you know what you're using and utilize those. Because if you think that you can just put all residential, you're mistaken.
Not going to work, is it? Not going to work at all. Yeah. And well, we've sort of come up to about an hour and 15 minutes now. There's so much more I could ask you, so much more I could go on to. But I just wanted to say, obviously, a massive thank you for sort of coming on and talking about your process, talking about your experience and sort of how you go about things. It's been really interesting to get an insight, and I'm sure for the listeners as well, to sort of hear that it's not all fun and games. It's not all that you see on Instagram. It is sort of so much going on in the background, so much to learn from. And there'll be sort of links to all the social media, to all of the YouTube, Instagram, merchandise all below. But yeah, just a massive thank you for coming on and sort of being so open and so honest about what you guys do at Tiny Heirloom.
Yep, I appreciate it. And we'll leave it to be continued, and then we'll come back on and do an update.
Exactly. Definitely. There's lots more coming in the future.
Yep, absolutely.
Amazing. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having us.
As always, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Tiny House Ideas podcast. If you've got any questions, any suggestions, any questions for future episodes, any ideas, then please do get in touch. Instagram's the easiest way to reach me, at Tiny House Ideas. If you'd like to support the podcast, as I've mentioned, it's available on Patreon to support, and we've got a private Discord group there where we can have the discussion. We can really break down the podcast, talk about each episode, talk about upcoming episodes, and also watch all of the new releases early.